Okay, Parshat Vayichi. Parshat Vayichi takes 71 years from the death of Yaakov, who lived 17 years in Egypt. Then we tack on another 54 years till Yosef passes away. So we have all together 71 years. All in all, Yosef becomes the viceroy at the age of 30, dies at 110. We don't see that he stopped being viceroy, so it would seem like he was viceroy for 80 years in Egypt. That's why at the beginning of Shmos, that's big chiddush, here's a new generation that doesn't know Yosef. Yosef was a viceroy for 80 years. Sort of like, how do you not know him? Yaakov senses the end is near and makes Yosef swear to him that he'll bury him in Eretz Yisrael and not in Egypt. Says the Ramban, why does he make him swear? Because without the oath, he might not feel that he has to fight with Paro. But once he swore to his father that he'll bury him in Eretz Yisrael, he eventually does. He fights with Paro, and because of the oath, Paro gives in and allows Yaakov to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Yaakov is accompanied by his children, and he wanted his children and grandchildren to realize Egypt is not home. Especially, if you recall what we said last year, the end of Parsha Vayigash is Vayachzu b'hem. Right? It seems like the land grabbed onto them. They were starting to become Egyptians. They fell into the snare of Egyptian culture. So Yaakov wanted to let them know that Egypt is not home. Yaakov was the first person in Tanakh to have a relationship with his grandchildren. Gemara says whenever a grandfather teaches his grandchildren, it's as if they received the Torah from Har Sinai, right? Jumping generations. It's a very, very cool thing. Baruch Hashem, I was Zocha. I learned with my grandchildren. It's a fantastic thing. Gemara says, he then says that Ephraim and Menashe, his grandchildren, will be for him like Reuben and Shimon. Gemara says, B'nei banim kebanim heim. His grandchildren like children. And the Baal Turim points out that the gematria for Reuben and Shimon is the same as gematria as Ephraim and Menashe. Okay? So Ephraim and Menashe will be for me like Reuben and Shimon. According to the Gemara Baba Basra, Kuf Chaf Aleph Amet Bet, this is, what does it mean they'll be like Reuben and Shimon? They'll get two different portions. Really, Reuben and Shimon got two different portions in Eretz Israel. Ephraim and Menashe, you might have thought they should just share the portion of Yosef. No. They have two different portions. And we see from here that Yosef gets a double portion. Yosef becomes the Bechor, where Reuven didn't receive. Yosef receives. Reuven was the firstborn child of one mother, of one real wife, Leah. When he got disqualified, so he became the Bechor, the firstborn of the other real wife. Firstborn of Rachel is Yosef. So Yosef now becomes the Bechor, and the double portion, Ephraim and Menashe are like Reuven and Shimon. According to Rashi, the two portions, yes, but since the portion goes by population, Yosef got the same amount of land that he would have gotten anyway. If he would have gotten, let's say, you know, an area of 100 by 100 square kilometers, and now he still has 100 by 100, just divide into two, Ephraim and Menashe. So it really is not much of a change because it goes by the population. Population of Yosef is the same whether you call it Ephraim and Menashe or you don't. This is Rashi in Baba Basra. According to the Ramban, each Sheva got the same size. So if every Sheva got 100 kilometers by 100 kilometers, Yosef now got two of those portions, one for Ephraim and one for Menashe. Okay, so they got two portions, that's true. Machlokas, if they actually got a larger portion, it's Machlokas Rashi and Ramban. Now, it says later that Yosef brought them being Ephraim and Menashe, to Yaakov for a bracha, and he says, who are they? When told that they are his children, Ephraim and Menashe, Yaakov gives them brachot, but as we know, what does he do? Switches hands. Now, Yosef had them placed by his knees, and Yaakov, in front of Yaakov, and he situated them that Ephraim should be by Menashe should be by Yaakov's right hand, but he switches hands, puts his right hand on Ephraim and his left hand on Menashe, and that's when we have, he says, Hamalach HaGoloti, many of us said it before we go to sleep. So this is the bracha that he gives to Ephraim and Manasseh. When Yosef sees, he freaks out. He says, yo, dad, like, you know, we already had enough problems with stealing the Bechor between me, last generation. Like, I don't need to do this again. And I set it up for you. And he goes, Yadati bini, Yadati, I know, I know. And he says, they're both good, but the younger will be greater. Okay.
Ephraim's younger?
Ephraim's younger. Now, the story sounds strange. We just got finished saying that Yaakov said that Ephraim and Manasseh are going to be like Reuben and Shimon. So why do we have a few psukim later, Yosef bringing them for bracha, and Yaakov saying, who are they? I mean, it would seem as if he should know. He just said, they're to me like Reuben and Shimon. So Rashi is forced to come up with all sorts of ideas, quoting Midrashim. But Rabbi Yaakov Meidan wants to suggest that this story about the bracha to Ephraim and Asha happened when Yaakov first arrived in Eretz Yisrael. And the story is written out of order. We know that the Torah is not written necessarily in chronological order. A muktam umuchar b'Torah. And
when he got in Eretz
Yisrael? What?
When he went to Eretz Yisrael, he said?
When he comes to Egypt. If I said Eretz, I made a mistake. When Yaakov came to Egypt, right when he first came and he meets Yosef, and then he gives the bracha. And Rav Meidan says it makes sense because think about what I just told you. Where did Yosef situate them? By his knees, right? Sounds like, how old are these kids? They're kids. They're little kids, right? Now, if it's right before Yaakov died, so I just got finished telling you, how many years was Yaakov in?
17
years. Now, he also came after there were 7 years of plenty, 2 years of famine. So Yosef is already in Mitzrayim 9 years. It was during the years of plenty that Yosef had his children. So you have 17 plus, at least, I don't know, three, more than that. The youngest one's at least 20. The older one's older than 20. It would seem a little bit odd to have these 20-year-olds situated by his knees. Therefore, Rav Meidan wants to suggest that they were now 3, 4, 5 years old. He had them by his knees, maybe sitting on his knees, and Yaakov gives the bracha. Why is it situated here? Because we didn't want to interrupt the flow of the story of Yaakov coming down, but right now we're about to talk about all the brachot that he gives to his own children. So once we talk about all the brachot he's going to give to Reuben and Shimon, we could talk about the bracha that he gave to his grandchildren. Right? To me, this makes a lot of sense. So that story, it's written out of order. That happened in the beginning. He gives him bracha malach goalti. Ephraim is greater than Manasseh. Then later on, he also mentions that they're going to be like Reuben and Shimon, and he goes into the whole idea of the brachot for Reuben and Shimon and everyone else.
He makes them because they were young.
Because they were young. So he says, and that's why he asks, who are these? He just got there. He goes, who are these?
Ah, okay.
Right? So he goes, these are my kids. These are my kids. Oh, she gives him a bracha. And then, also makes sense, oh, Avi, you don't get it. The younger one's a little bit tall for his age. That's why you think he's old. You know, no. It's like, I know that he's older. And he's switching hands because he sees in the future, Rashi tells us who's going to come from them. Yeshua comes from Ephraim. Okay, great. But according to Rabbi Meidan, this story happened like so basically in last week's Parsha, in Vayigash. But we're just told it now, because now is when he's giving all the brachot. Now he's giving all the brachot. Yes.
Do we not know any of the other Shvatim's kids? Like, we only hear about Manasseh and Ephraim.
Right. We have the other Shvatim's kids in Vayigash. It lists the 70 people that came down. It says the names, but they're special for us because they got these brachot. Now, according to both, a lot of people in this room, I'm sure, don't know this. According to the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra, Yosef had other kids. But Ephraim and Manasseh, these are the ones that get the brachot. These are the ones that have the two portions because they're taking over for Yosef. And all the other kids that Yosef had, they're going to be living in either Shevet Ephraim or Shevet Manasseh. Yosef wasn't like Yaakov that he had. He might have had, for all we know, 12 kids. Doesn't matter. Those two kids become Yosef, split portion, double portion. You know, the double portion we say go to the Bechor. But according to the Ibn Ezra Rabban, he didn't just have two kids. He had more. But these are the two that get the brachot. Okay?
Why were they special?
They were the ones that were alive when he comes in. He's giving the brachot, and they're taking the portion of we're giving a double portion. It was taken from Reuven, so now Yosef gets a double portion. Instead of saying Yosef 1 and Yosef 2, we'll say it by Ephraim and Manasseh's two oldest children. Okay? Now, anyone here have the minhag in your family that on Friday night your parents give you brachot? Okay, and what do they say? That you should be like? Okay. So why do they say that you should be like Ephraim and Manasseh?
I always thought they were giving us the bracha bet.
Oh, so very good. One of the ideas that's stated is these are the first brothers that we have in Tanakh that actually get along. Very sad when you think about it. We went through all of Chumash Bereishis. We're 2,500 years into, 2,000 years into into history of mankind. And the first time that we have brothers that get along are Ephraim and Manasseh. And they had reasons not to. Ephraim could have been arrogant and trash talked his brother, ha, I got the firstborn, and Manasseh had a reason to be jealous, that his brother superseded him when he didn't do anything wrong. And yet, no jealousy, no arrogance. They got along. And that's basically what every parent really wants from their kids. Just get along. I say it all the time. If my kids show me honor, that's nice. But there's nothing gives me more nachas when I see that they get along. And I sort of feel that God must feel the same way. We can give him honor, but I think what he finds most pleasing is when he sees that we get along. If we get along, that must give him nachas the same way when my kids get along, gives me nachas. Much more than any honor we show him. Just like when we get along as a parent, that makes me feel great. The Netziv points out that Yaakov switched their hands instead of moving the kids. Why? Why would he switch instead of moving the kids? What do you think? Okay, first of all, it would be sort of like, I don't know, offensive to Menashe. No. Move over here. Move to the back of the line, right? So he doesn't want to move them around. But the Netziv has this idea that Ephraim's not better than Menashe in everything. Just in this particular bracha of Ruchnius, spiritual things. But when it comes to physical things, Menashe is greater. And therefore, in Parshat Pinchas, when they list the tribes to enter Eretz Yisrael, Menashe is mentioned first. Okay? So now it's talking about entering the land, gathering the land. After the bracha to the kids, Yaakov tells Yosef he's giving him an extra portion. The portion is in Shechem as a reward for arranging his burial. This is the way Rashi and the Marshal understand why Dafke he's getting this extra portion. Torah doesn't say explicitly, but since I'm asking you to make sure I get buried in Eretz Yisrael, here's a little tip, And there you get Shechem. Now Yaakov calls his 12 sons and gives them brachot. The Abarbanel points out that these are a combination of brachot, also tochacha, rebuke, and also nevuah, sort of foretelling the future, and sort of dealing with a little bit the portions of their land they're going to get in Eretz Yisrael. So there's a whole bunch of things put together. In a nutshell, what does each person basically receive? Reuven is told, you're losing the Bechorah. You lose the firstborn because you were impetuous. You acted in a rash way. You didn't think things through. And we're dealing with which sin? What did he do? Something with Bila. Whatever it was with Bila, we already discussed. Maybe he moved the bed. Maybe he actually slept with her. Right? Different opinions. But whatever he did was not thought out. And because of his haste, he loses the firstborn privilege. Reuven loses it.
He moved the bed.
Move the bed. Like that's what we're used to. That's what Rashi says. But others say he actually slept with Bila. That's what it says in the pasuk.
So his mother can sleep with Yaakov.
He slept with his father's concubine.
Reuven moved the bed.
Moved the bed or slept with her. Like I said, the pshat is he slept with her. Rashi brings the midrash that he only moved the bed. Either way, it was disrespectful to his father. It was disrespectful to Bila, and he gets punished. Okay?
What was the purpose of moving the...
So you could argue he acted for the sake of his mother, for the honor of his mother. He was acting, you know, he had very good intentions. Even with those good intentions, in the end, it was disrespectful to his father and disrespectful to his father's concubine, and therefore he gets punished. You know, like, he could do tshuva, and that's great. But if you want to be the leader, which what the Bechor is, so then you need deliberate decision-making and not hasty decisions. And therefore, he was disqualified from his leadership role because he didn't think things through. This is what we're taught.
Why didn't it fall to Shimon then?
Because he's not the firstborn. Bechor has to be the firstborn. Yosef is the firstborn. Now, Shimon and Levi also get rebuked. Right? They acted zealously. They, you know, joined together. And as we know, what did they do? They destroyed Shechem. Now, it doesn't mean that what they did was an absolute evil act. It just has to be properly channeled. To be zealous is not a bad thing. It just depends what you're using it for. So later on in Jewish history, we're going to have a descendant of Levi act zealously and be rewarded. A descendant of Shimon act zealously and be punished. I'm referring to Zimri and Pinchas. Zimri from Shimon acts zealously on behalf of his tribe and goes and sleeps with a Moabite woman, and Pinchas, a descendant of Levi, goes and kills the two of them in the act. They both acted zealously, but Levi was able to channel it for good, while Shimon was still, you know, his descendant, channeling it for bad. Later on for Levi, we have Levium here, Benny's a Levi, so the Chashmonaim are from Shevet Levi, actual Kohanim, and they say, we begin what's it called? What's Alanisim that we say in the benching? Or on Shmon Esrei, we say, Bimei Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol. So Matityahu was the son of Yochanan Kohen Gadol. Okay, or he himself was a Kohen Gadol, depends how where you put the comma on the Kohen Gadol. But they were Kohanim. And what did they say? Mila Hashem Elai, and they fought the good fight. So being zealous is not a bad thing. It's just how it's used. And this is the message that they're told. It's interesting. Chazal say that both Levi and Shimon become teachers. Because in order to be a teacher, you have to be passionate. If you're not passionate, your students aren't going to learn anything. You have to be passionate. Okay, most people that go into a certain career, it's because they had a passionate teacher that lit a fire. So you need passion. Both Levi and Shimon were teachers. So again, being zealous, being passionate, not a bad trait. Just the way they used it in Chumash Bereishis is what Yaakov ridicules. Then we get to Yehuda, the first of the brachas, who finally gets a bracha. Okay? And he is told, the brothers will recognize your greatness. Okay? Kings will come from you. Mashiach will come from you. He has already proven himself with, where did Yehuda prove his medal?
Binyamin.
What else? Tamar. Good. Not killing Yosef before. He stands up. Okay, convincing Yaakov to bring Binyamin before he then argues to save Binyamin. Right? Yehuda shows leadership qualities, and the brothers all saw it, and Yaakov says they'll continue to see it. Your descendants will all be like you, leaders, and this is the bracha that he's given. What do you want to say to you?
He takes his responsibility.
Yes. Yes. Then we have Zvulun. Zvulun.
Wait, what about Yosef?
Yes, what?
I thought Yosef was first.
So, Zvulun's mentioned first because what did Zvulun do? He was a merchant.
We
see his boundaries are until Sidon, which is up north Lebanon. He supports Yisachar. And because Yisachar is only able to learn because he's supported by Zvulun, Zvulun gets mentioned first. Right? Zvulun gets mentioned first. It's a very interesting thing. I think I've mentioned this before. I thought it was very, very appropriate. Once there's a periodical called Jewish Action. They had a whole issue dedicated to the great lay leaders that pushed and helped fund the building of these big yeshivas. Everyone knows the names of the Rosh yeshivas of all these big yeshivas, and no one knows the people behind the scenes. And they did a whole issue about the people behind the scenes. And that's Zvulun. Zvulun is the guy behind the scenes. He's the silent partner in all of Yisachar's learning. And the Torah gives him this bracha first. Even before we get to Yisachar, the scholar. Then we get to Yisachar, and we say that his land is blessed, and that he carries the burden which Chazal understand, the burden of Torah, and becomes, you know, Torah scholars. We're then...
What did they say about Zvulun, though?
The merchant talks about his boundaries, and it, you know, and supporting Yisachar. Dan. Shevet Dan are considered warriors, taking revenge against the enemy. According to Chazal, talking about one particular descendant of Dan,
Shimshon,
very good. Right, with a very unique ending. At the end of the bracha, we have like a tefillah, where Yaakov says, Li Yeshuascha Kivisi Hashem, I pray for your salvation. Very, very strange ending. Okay, fits in beautifully with our understanding of Shimshon, which Aaron's heard me say on another occasion. Then we get to God. God is also a warrior. He's involved in military adventure. Okay? Then we get to Asher. Here it just talks about his blessed land, especially olives. And Naphtali is blessed fruit and a very fast messenger. Okay? Swift like a deer. Naphtali is blessed fruit. Blessed fruit, perot. Okay? And he's a very fast messenger. He, according to Midrash, he's the one that ran back to get the document to prove that Yaakov could be buried in Rata Machpelah. And who ends up, according to the Midrash, killing Esav? Do you know this? You already brought it up. Do you already know it?
Until he's killed.
Blind, grandson of Dan.
Deaf, good. Chushim ben Dan. You said that they have names. Chushim ben Dan is the one son of Dan who is deaf. So according to the Gemara in Sota, I'll go off the tangent because Benny brought it up. According to the Midrash, we're going to get to soon the burial of Yaakov. Esav stopped him and said, hey, there's only one more plot left. Yaakov and I both got a plot. He already used his to give to Leah. I'm keeping the other one. I said, no, it's all part of the thing when you sold him the birthright, you sold him everything, you got this plan. We have the document. He goes, show me the document. Oh, we left in Egypt. Oh, so I see the document, no one goes past me. So they sent Naphtali running back. In the meantime, Esav is explaining to them, and he's winning them over. Because according to the Gemara, Esav was a hunter, but it says a hunter bepiv. What's a hunter bepiv?
His mouth.
So according to this idea that I think it's the Maharal, he was a smooth talker. And therefore, everyone's listening to him. This guy's got a point. But Chushim ben Dan, he was deaf. So did he hear all this charm, all this smooth talking? No. He just said, my grandfather is sitting here in the sun, and he's not letting him bear him. He just took a club and smacked his head right off. Enough of the smooth talk. The deaf guy knew what was going on. He wasn't won over by all the sly remarks. And that's how Yaakov got buried. According to the Midrash, Esav's head as well rolled in there. Okay, fine. End of Midrash. It's Gemara and Sota as well. Back to here. We then up to Yosef. Yosef gets a double portion, as we said before. It says that Yosef was good looking. Yosef had a lot of charm. And he was the sustainer. The Mechalkel, we say every time when we say Shemoneh Esrei, Mechalkel Chaim Bechesed. He sustained the family. There came a famine, he sustained the family. Talks about how he overcame his Yetzirah, and he gets Birchat Shamayim V'aretz, and also Birchat Avot. Gets all these beautiful brachot. And then the last, Binyamin. He's a courageous warrior. The beginning of the Malchus starts with him. Who's the first king in Israel? From Shaul, from Binyamin. And we continue with leaders till Mordechai helps save the Jewish people. And in his portion, we have the most important building, and that's the Beit HaMikdash. What?
Mordechai comes from Binyamin?
Mordechai comes from Binyamin. Yeah. the Beis Hamikdash and the Chelik of Binyamin for the most part, like 95%. A little bit is in Yehuda. The Gemara Megillah that we're going to get to after Pesach says Yehuda was so pained. I'm sorry, Binyamin was so pained by that even a little bit was in Yehuda. He wanted it all to be by him. Okay?
So we're in Binyamin's land right now.
What?
So we're living in
where we are right now might be in the Yehuda still part. Over there. I'm not exactly sure, but the Beis Hamikdash is in Binyamin. Now, Yaakov recognizes the differences of each kid. And this is so important. Sometimes parents make the mistake of treating their kids the same. We said once before, the Rosh Hashanah Hirsch, he says the reason why Esav went off the Derech is because Yitzchak and Rivka brought Yaakov and Esav up the same way, and they're different kids. And it wasn't fair to expect Esav to go through the same schooling as Yaakov. They're different people. And here we have this beautiful example of Yaakov having 12 sons and giving all of them their own bracha, recognizing each one as being a different personality, but together becoming one great team. Every single person, you know, pulling his weight. Even the best quarterback, if he has no offensive line, can't get anything done. So everyone, every single person needs to pull his weight, and Yaakov realizes this, and he gives everyone a bracha, a division of labor. Basically, Reuven, Gad, and Menashe dealt with the livestock, with the cattle. Shimon, Levi, and Yisachar, they're like teachers. Yehuda, kings. Zvulun, merchant. Naphtali and Asher, agriculture. And Binyamin and Ephraim are soldiers. And Dan is, you know, the judges. What do you want to say, Teal?
Dan is a judge?
Is a warrior? Dan Yadina, yeah, he's like a judge. I said warrior, but also like a judge.
Okay. So
yeah, before I said warrior. Yaakov left a lasting legacy. And because of that, Chazal say, Yaakov vino lo met. Now, what does it mean? Literally, it means Yaakov didn't die. Okay? Yaakov didn't die. Now, we hope he died because we buried him. Right? They embalmed him and buried him. So if he was alive, that would be pretty bad. So Yaakov Avinu Lomet means all of his children carried on his legacy. That's the beauty of Yaakov Avinu Lomet. You know, I went to pay a Shiva call yesterday. That's what I say every time I go to pay a Shiva call. That, you know, your parents are still alive, you're carrying on the legacy. That's what we learn. Yaakov Avinu Lomet, you carry on the legacy. So then he doesn't really die. My son, there's a quick aside. Once my son was in high school and he went to the late minyan in my community, which was the Chabad minyan, and it was Parshas Vayechi. And I said, Eli, what was the Dvar Torah? He goes, Abba, it was a Chabad. What do you think it was? Yaakov Avinu Lomet. Okay, if you didn't get that, that's fine. But for those who did, so you can understand why they would talk about Yaakov Avinu Lomet. Anyway, moving right along. When Yaakov will be buried, yes, sir.
Why don't we say that for Avram? Like, Avram never died and Yitzchak never died.
Because they each didn't have all their sons carrying on the legacy. They had kids that went off the derech. Yaakov has all of his kids following, carrying on his legacy. When Yaakov will be buried in the Maratha Machpelah, he'll be the last of the four couples to be buried there. When he dies, he's embalmed 40 days. And he is mourned for 70 days in Egypt before they set out for Eretz Yisrael. Now, Chazal say, even though embalming is, you know, that was the minhag in Egypt, that was certainly not the Jewish custom. So why did Yosef allow him to be embalmed? So Chazal say, because Yosef knew Yaakov was a tzaddik, his body would not deteriorate. The bodies of tzaddikim do not deteriorate. And he felt that there was going to be a 70-day mourning period. If his body would not decay, they would say, oh my God, he's a god. Oh my God, he's a god. And they'd start to worship him. So therefore, he allowed Yaakov to be embalmed, so they would think that's the reason why the body didn't decay. Obviously, because he was embalmed. So he allowed it so that he should not be turned into an avodah zarah. Yeah.
What's embalmed?
Okay. They put all the sorts of chemicals on the body so the body doesn't decay. Okay? Yes.
70 days of mourning.
Yes, 7-0. That was the Egyptian minhag.
Okay.
They mourned for him. Yes. Yes, Aaron.
Well, by your like what you said about a tzaddik doesn't deteriorate. You just look at tzaddik. It specifically said his bones are taken back.
Okay. When it says that, I don't know what it necessarily means. But there is an idea. It doesn't say it in the Chumash. Okay. There is this idea. It says specifically about Reuben, his bones were all over the place. I'm sorry, Yehuda's bones were all over the place. That it does say. And that, was it Yehuda? Or Reuven, one of them, one davens for the other one. I think Reuven's bones and Yehuda davens for him. And then they was able to come back into the skeleton. Yeah, so there it does talk about bones. But I don't know. There's an idea. Now, Parah agrees for Yosef to accompany the family to Eretz Yisrael, although he keeps a whole bunch of things in Egypt as leverage, his family and his kids, make sure he doesn't just like leave and go to Israel. That would be terrible if a Jew left Chutzlars and went to Israel. We wouldn't want that to happen.
Yeah.
I know. And Yaakov is given a royal guard. When they enter Eretz Yisrael, they sit Shiva, and then the sons carry him to Marat HaMachpelah, and then they return to Egypt. Now, after the funeral, the brothers are nervous that Yosef would take revenge. Maybe, you know, Yosef waited out of respect for Yaakov, that, you know, they didn't want to do anything while Yaakov was alive, similar to who? Who also was going to wait till their father died? Esau was going to wait till Yitzhak died before he would, you know, kill Yaakov. So this is what they were maybe thinking. So now they go over to Yosef, the brothers do, and they say, Abba said not to exact revenge upon us. Mm-hmm. It's not clear if Yaakov ever even knew what the brothers did to Yosef. Not clear at all if he ever knew. It's certainly not clear if Yaakov ever said such a statement. You know, Dad said not to exact revenge upon us. And therefore, this is brought as a proof that having peace trumps the truth. You're allowed to lie for the sake of peace, and the brothers lied over here for the sake of peace. Shalom versus MS. Shalom has to win, and therefore, if this was a made-up story, they were allowed to lie for the sake of peace. Yosef says, it was all from God. I would never think of hurting you. And now I want to end with a beautiful idea from Yonatan Grossman. Listen to this beautiful idea. It was worth coming today just for this idea. You ready?
Yes.
Rav Yoni Grossman points out such an interesting insight.
Who is the rabbi?
Rav Yonatan Grossman. He writes a lot. He teaches a lot. He says like this. He's alive today. Teacher all over Israel. He says like this. When the brothers were arrested, how did they view the arrest? Why were they arrested? Said we're being punished by God for what we did to Yosef. Right? That was their reaction. And similarly, when the goblet was found in the sack of Binyamin, they once again said that we are being punished for what happened with Yosef. Even though in both times Yosef exercised his free will to lock them up and to plant a goblet in the sack, their interpretation of the event was what? God is doing this to us. It's an onesh. And similarly, right, they view whatever is being done by the viceroy, he's an agent of God. And similarly now, when the brothers blame themselves for what they did to Yosef, and they come to Yosef and they say, we're so sorry, please don't take revenge on us for having thrown you in the pit and eventually you going down to Egypt, what is Yosef's reaction? You were just a shliach from Hashem. This is all from God. So, what a beautiful way of looking at it, right? You didn't send me to Egypt. God had a plan for me to come here and to be able to support the family. And if so, the important lesson is we should always view our actions as free will and take responsibility for every single thing that we do. But when someone does something to us, instead of getting angry at that person, what should we do? It's a message from God. I should look and say, what is God trying to teach me? This is exactly what everyone does at the end of Bereshis. Such a beautiful insight. How everyone, instead of like says, you did this to me, says, no, God did it. And they each take responsibility for their own act. They don't say, well, God made me do it to you. No. They take responsibility for their actions and yet view others' actions to them as a message from God. What do you want to say?
It's like it makes me think that to the story with David when a guy insults David,
and he's cursing him out. He says, it's
he
all
could be, he could
right.
Be, he could have killed him, but he didn't say.
He said, no, this book from God. Exactly. Yosef now dies at 110, was embalmed and put in a coffin. He merited,
for the same reason, right?
Because the Egyptian, yeah. He merited seeing not just grandchildren, but great-grandchildren. And before he dies, he instructs his family that when they make it back to Eretz Yisrael, because that's the goal for all Jews, Matan, to make it back to Eretz Yisrael, they should take his bones with them. And we'll stop here, continue with Sefer Shmos next time. All right. Finish. There you go. Very good.